Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 176, being recorded on the 27th of April, 2017, with special guest Jared Ross. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan, and our special guest, Jared. Unfortunately, it's Kale's turn to be out today. He's in between flights, apparently, somewhere. Evan, how was your offsite last week?
It was excellent. I listened to the show after, and you guys were making fun of us, but it's great when there's a theater near the office, and we rent the whole theater out, and it's all, you know, your coworkers and coworkers' family and kids, and it's a lot of fun. So that's nice. It's a good one. We do it once a year.
Oh, nice. Well, we definitely missed you last week, and glad to have you back this week. Let's start as usual with our round of updates. You put something in the blockchain area as usual, and our blockchain master is not with us today.
Yes, so I'm gonna do my best impression of Kale and say blockchain is cool, blockchain is fun. I thought this was really interesting because this was not your traditional blockchain, you know, conversation around banking or, you know, some of the other scenarios, purchasing and sales and contracts. What this was, and I've tried to find the add-in, I guess maybe we haven't released it yet, like we've talked about it publicly, but we have an add-in for Word where it uses blockchain to validate that the document has not been modified, or at least you know what the chain of events is, and there's no, you know, questioning what that order is, which, you know, I hadn't even thought about it in all the conversations we've had with Kale, like some of the even non-money, non-transactional things, there are items in the world that you want to make sure you understand what their history looks like.
Wow.
Right? And a document's a great example of that, right? You want to make sure that it has the changes by the right people in the right places, and it is the, you know, official copy, I guess.
It's a distributed validation, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really neat. So, I don't know what the timeline is for this being available for, you know, anybody to try or use, but I'll be looking forward to play with it.
Excellent. Well, you may remember a few weeks, many weeks ago, we had Asser over on the show to talk about the Azure Management Libraries for .NET. They were in preview at that time, and they've been made available now. He's got another post stating that they are currently, in generally available. And these, if you just to refresh our listeners, these are the .NET libraries that let you, create a VM and, you know, with the entire graph of resources as one. I'm going to pause. Somebody's IMing me. What's going on? Chaining. What is this?
So, oh no, it's me. I was saying some of the, you know, the newest features coming out with it. It's going to be the ability to allow you to create like a method chain. So really cool functionality there.
right. Yeah, the fluent syntax. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's what they call it in .NET terms. It's known as the fluent API, and that lets you, yeah, exactly. You can chain various things down the pipe. So you can say, you know, create a new VM or create the disk and, you know, it kind of like in one chain. So yeah, that's what you were talking about, Jared. And so they not only release it for .NET, but they also release it for Java, which is kind of nice. So, you know, you have your choice of languages as well.
I remember talking to the PM for this, and I forget the question around the value proposition of this. I mean, this is absolutely easier than, say, PowerShell.
Well, it's essentially one line of code to create the entire VM and all the artifacts associated with it, right? Literally one line of code. I mean, physically one line of code.
Right. Yep. Yeah. I guess the thing that I don't recall is, you know, why is my why is my PowerShell approach not this simple, right? Or why
Well,
is
because
the CLI
PowerShell doesn't
approach?
support the fluent, this fluent syntax, which lets you essentially, as Jared was saying, chain the results of one to the other, right?
Oh,
And
so
you're kind
it's
of building it up.
leveraging. Gotcha. It's leveraging the fact that the full C sharp world, the full .NET world allows that kind of structure. Oh, I got you. Okay.
And they've obviously used something similar in the Java world as well. I'm not a Java developer, so I don't know what they've used there, but something similar in that world as well. Okay, what else? And then the IoT gateway. You recall we talked about IoT a while ago, and there was this edge device on the, like a customer may have, like if you have a big building and you have like hundreds of IoT devices in there, you don't want all of them talking to the, to back to the internet directly. So you create a gateway device, and that gateway device acts as a proxy to talk to Azure, to the Azure IoT Hub. So that gateway device has an SDK. So if you need to connect to IoT Hub from that gateway device, you could use that SDK. And that was released last November, but they never created all the packages. And now they have like the NuGet and the Maven packages available, for various languages. So it's just a little more easier for developers to consume these. Just go on NuGet and you look for the IoT Gateway SDK and you'll find it out there. And then you could build code that sits in these edge devices. What else do you got? What else do you want to talk about, Adam?
Let's talk about the billing reader. This is all about the separation of roles, right? We've done things with RBAC, role-based access and control, to do things like, hey, you can manage and create a VM, but you can't update the virtual network, or you can update the virtual network and change the virtual network layout, but you can't update or access the machines in the virtual network, right? All those kind of permutations of this. Now you have the ability to delegate just the access to the billing and subscription information of the of your resources. And again, that you can what you can see is you can see, hey, I'm going to give my finance team access to this data, but I don't want the finance people to be able to update my VMs or update my SQL database or any of those kind of things. So it's again, it's just continuing to spread out the role-based access to the right resources, right people having access to the right resources.
Okay. Yeah, that's and they have to say, and you can do the API thing now, right? That so that's nice that you could get the invoices directly through an API, which is something that wasn't allowed earlier.
And I suspect that's probably targeted at like ISV type scenarios personally, because I'm not sure if individual users or companies are they're probably not going to use an API to get their invoice. But I mean, it's all about, again, exposing this stuff so that other layers, other tiers, other apps can call into it and get what they need.
And we didn't put it out here, and I didn't put it in the show notes, but we had DataAmp this week, right? It's kind of like a virtual, it's like a, like your tech ed and build, but this was kind of virtual just around data. And one of the Azure announcements that was made, or the things that they talked about, was how Microsoft builds massively scalable services using Azure Document DB. And they talk about, and they, so because Document DB is something that's becoming very popular, obviously, Microsoft themselves internally are using that, to create all the internal services and backing it with Document DB. And they can achieve that massive scale using Azure Doc DB. So there's a nice article on that. And I think folks should also go and listen to the keynotes from DataAmp. They do cover this in more detail there as well. I think that kind of rounds up all the updates, right, Evan? Okay, so then let's get to our special guest today, Jared Ross. I think both of us have known Jared in different ways.
I would say two different channels, but ultimately we know each other, so yeah.
But Jared, why don't you introduce yourself and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Sujit, Evan, thanks really for having me. It was great. My name's Jared Ross. I am a Azure consultant in Microsoft Consulting Services, focusing primarily on networking, compliance, and security in Azure. Today, I work with some of our largest enterprise customers, focusing on getting them through the digital transformation. And one of the most exciting things for me thus far from the Azure perspective is how much networking has played really in this new environment of hyperscale cloud computing. And I think that that's just a really exciting and cool kind of factor. I think Sujit and I were talking about this a few days ago, and it's just the massive scale of our engineering and product group teams that focus just on networking is really astounding today. So really great to be here once again. I look forward to taking some questions.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things, I'm an app dev guy, right, as you know. And I'll be honest with you, when app dev guys try to work with the cloud, networking is about the last thing they think about. Okay. it's like, you know, the cloud is supposed to kind of give
it
you
just
everything,
work.
Right?
Yeah.
So, okay, here's your platform. You drop your code onto the platform and we'll take it from there, right?
Yep.
Nobody really knows about IP addresses, blah blah blah, or routers and gateways and whatnot. Why has that become more important now, though? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so you know the way I look at it a lot of times is when you look at the traditional data center model where. As we've evolved through time where a developer can, like you said, really just deploy code into IIS and they don't really care about the underlying infrastructure. I think the flip side of it today, and this goes more into why we go into public cloud, is because of all of the advantages that the public cloud is going to have to offer. And, you know, just from an elasticity and scalability perspective, and we've talked about this with our customers before as well, is you know, part of the DevOps story has really evolved into being that in order for my application to really be optimized, I need to care about the infrastructure. And different platforms within the Azure environment definitely have different variables where I have to care about the infrastructure more as I look at the IaaS side of the house and less as I look at the PaaS side of the house. But, you know, like we've talked about before, knowing that I want to develop my app so that it can scale really well and run active-active, those are all going to be really important steps as we're looking towards deploying apps in the cloud directly.
Yeah, I think where I've seen it, because, you know, again, and been hanging out in this space for a long time, and I remember when, you know, it was oh my gosh, I can deploy this thing in a virtual network,
yep.
Right? I mean, I remember when we got that feature and that functionality, and it's interesting because back when we didn't know any better, we were thrilled because we didn't have to care at all about the underlying network and who was talking to who. I mean, there were some it was all pretty straightforward, but you didn't really have any control over it.
Yep.
Right. So I think that's the part that when I look at this, I look at and say, if I really don't care about my network, I don't have to. Right. I don't have to know. I mean, I can deploy everything in one VNet. They can all talk to each other. You know, I don't have to put, you know, web application firewalls. I don't have to put UDRs. I don't have to put, you know, network virtualized appliances. I don't have to do any of that, and it will just work for me.
Yep.
But on the other hand, if I'm somebody who really needs all that complexity for whatever reason, that capability exists as well.
Yep.
Right. So you kind of get to pick whichever one you want, right?
Yeah, and I think that that's like the greatest opportunity that we have from a Microsoft perspective as well, is that our ecosystem is massive, and it's not just the first party solutions that are really attractive. It's all of the third party ones that we have as well that really make it into an ecosystem that allows you to be a customer where I can run basically the same appliance or network hardware that I have on-prem as I do in the cloud. So it's really a great feature story, a really good parity between the talent that's on-prem today and in the cloud. And I think as you look at customers that are doing the big shift from the on-prem world, I think a lot of the concern comes up is, you know, are my people going to be able to utilize the new cloud environment? And that's the opportunity that I see is really great, is that our NVA providers are, like I said, basically a parity set of on-prem versus cloud. It's just where they're sitting. And I think that that's a great opportunity.
But then, you know, that brings up the question is, you know, should they be thinking about it in exactly the same way, right? If the whole idea of coming from on-prem to the cloud is so, you get some things off your plate, correct?
Yep.
And you're saying, oh, well, would I still have to take all this baggage with me to the cloud? Like, so
yep.
what?
Well, Well, go ahead, Jared. I'm curious to hear what you see, because you see a different kind of subset of this.
Yeah, so I mean, most of the industries that I work within are financial services, healthcare, et cetera, that are highly compliant markets. And the challenge from those compliant markets is that if you look at a lot of the regulation, you look at PCI, for example, PCI has a lot of stances that take a very infrastructure-focused approach and less so on application security, less so on identity access control boundaries. And because of that, they still need to be able to have the granularity and compliance options that kind of exist in our NVA and WAF space, rather than just being able to kind of pick it up and move it to the cloud and then have the functionality and the scale of the cloud. But I think that that's still going to be an important step for a good long while compliance regulations change and as our platform evolves as well. But I'd love to hear Evan's take on it as well from the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you kind of get the best of both worlds, right? It used to be, if you're on premises, we're talking about the highly compliant, highly regulated environments, right? There, they would end up having to layer in and spend so much effort and so much time on the security aspect that, and this is, again, where I make my living in support, they would have trouble because they just don't have the time or the capacity to do the security and the high availability, right? So they end up cutting some corners, right, to get the project out the door. What I think that I find in the cloud, especially as we get some of these more advanced networking capabilities, they have the ability to do both, right? Now they can say, hey, you know what, I need a web application firewall, a WAF in front of my app. Click a button there, I've got it. It's there. I can turn on, the OWASP rules, I can turn them off, I can adjust them. But oh, by the way, now I need four of those because my infrastructure has grown or my consumption has grown to the point where I need to go that up. I just deploy more of them, right? Instead of having to,
Go
acquire and
buy,
build
yeah.
and yeah, exactly. And so I think they get the security, but they also, it brings in the simplicity of the expansion that normally you wouldn't have that simplicity there.
Yep, and it's the flip side of it as well, which we're talking about with my current customer right now is it's not only the scaling out of it's the scaling back in as well. At
Yes.
3 o'clock in the morning, I don't need four WAF devices side by side. I might only need two, and the cost benefit from just being able to scale in, and this is not just from an NVA perspective, this is all up Azure, but there are a lot of customers that aren't at the fundamental aspects yet of what I see as one of the biggest benefits is that scale in as well, because scaling out is great because, like you said, you can't just go and buy new hardware when you're on-prem, but in the cloud, you can.
Well, and I think I think to your point, the reverse is true. In the on-premises world, you can't just give it back when you're done with it for the day,
Nope, you've
right?
sunk it
Once you bought
already.
it, you're stuck with it, right?
Yep.
That might be the case, but see, at least in the on-prem world, when it comes to networking, you have all these tools to let you monitor the network, your consumption, right? Your bandwidth utilization. You connect to the switch, and you get also the statistics. I don't know if we have that same level of visibility if with all with our stuff in Azure, whether we can get that visibility. But isn't there a risk that we're going to saturate the network without knowing it in Azure?
I would, if you manage to saturate the network capacity that we have underneath these machines, I'm impressed. I mean, I anybody that I've ever seen that quote unquote has, they think they've hit a network cap, it's almost always
On their
that,
side.
yeah, there, well, there are some fringe cases, right? Again, I live in the world of the really broken, but the vast majority of the time that the limitation is something else in their app, right? It's CPU affinitized, right? So they're bound there or whatever. But yeah, I think that's where some of the infinite capacity comes in, right? Where really the, and I'm trying to, I think this was Albert Greenberg, no, it was Yusuf Khalidi published this at, I can't remember what the occasion was, but there was an article on the networking blog within the Azure documentation space talking about what we've done in terms of allowing us to, in the same physical space, deploy much, much more capacity. And we're deploying I don't remember if it was 100 gig or 10 gig lines, but like an order of magnitude larger than the vast majority of people deploy because we have that extra space.
Yep.
So we can deploy the extra capacity because, you know, I would be impressed if somebody manages to fill that. And that is the difference from in the on-premises world. You do have to care about that because that is something you have to go in and acquire that. Yep. Additional right. capacity.
I think, Sujit, though, you're talking more about some of the more, not, I don't even call them edge cases. I want to talk more about that hybrid model where, you know, today, and I think that's a huge value add as well, is that I can connect my on-prem and cloud environment, Azure environment, in a lot of different ways. But I mean, the most common that we see in big enterprises is the express route where I can connect into an existing MPLS environment that I already have for my company and do a direct connect from there. Really cool technology, but it has scaling limits as well. And I think part of that is how do I work in an ecosystem that's not just Azure, not just on-prem, but also a third-party vendor as well. And that's takes some close coordination. You know, we've got a good product that just dropped a couple of weeks ago called Network Watcher, which is starting to have some of this functionality. And as more features light up where we're going to see more express route monitoring, for example, I think that's where it's going to start becoming a really good story around sort of the network diagnostic, the network monitoring aspect of the express route. Because I think it's a paradigm in a sense, almost. You know, obviously there are physical aspects of ExpressRoute, but there are also virtual aspects within our SDN as well that are going to be really hard to be able to kind of trace down. And, you know, I look at something that I worked with one of my customers recently where, you know, there are so many hops to be able to get from my VNet within Azure back on-prem. And so having to work through some of those challenges were, to say the least, very challenging.
Right.
And I think that we, you know, we had some really good success about how we could kind of isolate it down. And, you know, it all came down to some of the most basic tools as well. You know, we did a PS ping to a router device with the provider, and we were able to see pretty consistent packet loss. So really cool, just very basic troubleshooting that got us all the way there.
So I'm glad you mentioned PS ping, because one of the things I wanted to talk about is the fact that we don't support the regular ping, right? The
ICMP, yep.
ICMP
yep.
ping.
Yep.
And so, well, remind me, what's the reason for that? Like, is that just security or is that something else?
So it's challenging, you know, so in a physical network world where I've got a physical router or a switch or a VM endpoint, it's really easy to support that because you know each hop and you know that it can respond to an ICMP call out. The challenge from a software-defined networking side is that you're going to take a lot of different paths that will not actually show up as a latent call or even packets going through because they are happening at the layer where we're not going to respond to an ICMP call. And so it's really interesting. And I know that there's a lot of work being done to see, you know, is there feasibility around this? Because it's, you know, a lot of customers are definitely interested in it. And there are some capabilities, you know, like you said, it's not fully supported, but there are niche cases where we do see value still in doing ICMP, and especially in the hybrid world where you've got a lot of physical devices, it's usually pretty good in that circumstance. But PS ping is definitely, you know, TCP traffic is always going to be easier to be able to send through. And I, you know, I'd love to hear if Evan has any additional thoughts on ICMP.
My understanding is there's some technical limitations as well, you know, dealing with just the scale.
Yep.
At which the world lives. I'm not enough of a hardcore networking person from the on-premises world to really, you know, understand why, you know, somebody would prefer ICMP over versus, you know, PS ping. If just because the fact that PS ping is, you know, at the end of the day, TCP is a more reliable protocol, right? And most communications are going to be with TCP IP these days, right? I mean, you can certainly have some UDP, and there's ways to do that as well. But so, yeah, I'm not sure if I have a grasp on why everybody wants it so much. because I found I can do almost everything with PS Ping, but it is absolutely a little bit of a mindset shift if you're not used
well,
to
it. Wait, wrong. PS Ping all it requires you to know the port number, correct?
Correct. Well, PS Ping is sending a true TCP payload.
And then
versus...
in a regular ping, you don't need to know the port. You just give it the IP address.
Because ICMP is a portless protocol. Correct. And I think that's important, though, because, you know, the reason why I'm going to use ICMP is because I don't have to send payload with it. Right. Obviously, even, you know, sending a PS Ping within the tool, it's not a massive payload, but there is a... There's a difference when you're looking for kind of minuscule details or minuscule kind of deviations. ICMP, because it's not carrying payload, doesn't really hold any... It doesn't have a heavy weight to it versus the TCP packet does. Again, it's, you know, for most cases where you're looking for something where, you know, the case that I was talking about where, you know, we were seeing 20% packet loss.
You're going to notice that.
It's not going to matter whether or not, you know, you've got a massive payload or you've got an ICMP traffic. You're going to see it no matter what. So
that's a good point. So then how, like, what's the strategy? So it sounds like we have to take some we got to know something about the network, right, when you're in the cloud. Yep. But how do we make the applications such that they're a little more resilient to, you know, I'm sure networks go up and down occasionally, right? There's no 100% network. There's always some packet loss to be expected.
Yep. I can talk about it from the infrastructure side. You know, I can definitely, and I've done this before with customers where, you know, the high-level guidance has to be that, you know, you want to be able to have your layers be redundant wherever possible and light them up within different regions within Azure. And, you know, you give the example a lot of times where you see, I've traditionally run it in one region, or traditionally we'll go back even on-prem and we'll say on-prem I run it in just one data center, but that's part of the scale of the cloud as well. And so maybe I run it in US East and US West as an active. And, you know, it always comes back to how's the data layer going to do it. And, you know, when you brought up DocDB, that's a great example of a really good use case. Obviously not a relational model. So going from a SQL to a DocDB is not a trivial task by any means, but, you know, the value that I see in DocDB as we're looking at making our apps more resilient is definitely having that true active model. And I think that's, you know, a lot of what I see with customers from the networking perspective of it is that, you know, I get to run these in multiple data centers, use something like a traffic manager or a global routing capability to be able to run in true active from a networking perspective. And then if I decide that I need to take US West down for maintenance, I pull it out of rotation within traffic manager and I continue to send traffic. What I see with customers today is, you know, they run the on-premises load balancing stack, and because I'm not doing it at a DNS layer like Traffic Manager does, for example, I still have the failover time that a physical load balancer mm-hmm. is going to do. So I see a lot of benefit. I see a lot of customers that are looking at global Traffic Manager type capabilities because that's where I see a lot of the value.
Yeah. The other thing, Sajid, too, you know, going back to your point about, you know, trying to, you know, looking for problems in your network and troubleshooting that. It's interesting because, again, even coming from the networking support team, right, where we only see the stuff that's broken, mm-hmm. even in that world, the vast majority of the time, even in our world, it's not a quote-unquote network problem, right? Customers may think it is. They may attribute it to it. You know, and we have had some. You know, we had a BGP spine problem at one point. You know, but what I find is always interesting is in your on-premises world, and this is certainly, you know, the biggest enterprise customers or enterprise companies have people on their staff that are dedicated to doing nothing but the network, right? But the percentage of companies out there that really have that much control and that much specialization over their own data center and are able to, you know, ensure the high quality of that data center at all times. It's a very small number, right? The vast majority of customers have some poor sysadmin who said, you must maintain the SQL server, the Exchange server, and oh, by the way, make sure the network doesn't go down.
Yeah.
Right? And the poor sysadmin's going, okay, I plugged everything in. I hope I don't lose any packets. Right? I mean, because that they just don't have the expertise. They don't have the specialization to be able to do it. We literally have tens and hundreds of people running around who that's all they do.
Yep.
Is live with that layer and live with that world. So really, as a percentage of time, I mean, you won't generally find these kinds of problems. Not saying they don't exist. I don't want to get a whole bunch of calls tomorrow from everybody, hey, but I have it. You know, so they absolutely do exist, and that's why we have support teams and engineering teams that focus on that. But it's, you know, that's part of the beauty of the, you know, public cloud is you're able to kind of step away from that stuff and move to a higher level, like Jared was talking about, where you're focused on my functionality, my ability to fail over. Like, I don't have to worry about configuring the load balancer. I just make a setting change on my traffic manager.
Yep. It just works. I mean, that's, you know, we say that, you know, that's one of the values of the cloud. And obviously, getting to the point where your application is truly resilient across tiers and across multiple regions is not a trivial task. I don't want to downplay that by any means, but some of the functionality like Traffic Manager, where I can point to two separate external load balancers and be able to do failover, do performance-based routing or round-robin-based routing, it just works like that. And that's, you know, I think a really powerful option as you move into the cloud, because you don't have that type of, you will never have that type of scale that our Azure environment does. It's impossible.
Right. So that, you know, that brings up, you mentioned about security and compliance as well. And
yep.
I'm just thinking, so if you have to harden, let's say a server, Windows, just take Windows because that's just easier. And okay, there's some things that you can do from within the Windows, right? To block yep. ports, firewalls, etc. The Windows firewall. What else can you do in the Azure space to offer another set of protection layer? I've heard about NSGs and things like yep. that. Like, yeah, can you just give us a few tips over there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we look as we, and I'll go external in actually, because I think that that's a good way of looking at it. And you know, as you hit our external endpoints, you know, our traditional guidance is never going to be, don't have a system that sits right on the end, right on the edge, rather. Put something in front of it. And so typically what I'll do is I will put an external load balancer, Azure's load balancer that's in an external mode, and have an inbound NAT rule, a network address translation, that's going to allow traffic in from a specific external port. And what I'm going to do typically is look at some of our options to see what's going to be the best sort of use case. And, you know, up front, I'll say maybe the application gateway. Application gateway is going to be, you know, an ADC, an application delivery controller, but also it's going to do some of the layer 7 load balancing. It's going to have the WAF capabilities to be able to do SSL termination, SQL mm-hmm. injection, and things like that. And so that's going to be my next layer of defense before I even hit the endpoint, before I even hit the application. SSL term is really good too. Layer 7 inspection is going to be really important when I want to be looking at the actual application payload, as I'm getting into the application layer, to be able to see, is there anything malicious from within there? And in order to do that, I need to be able to terminate the session that was established from the end user before I hit the origin. And so having those types of devices are going to be key. Layer 7 is not trivial though, and it's not necessarily simple. As I break open that existing packet, because I have my private keys for my term, it's going to be really important that I have the capabilities to scale that as well. And that's part of what we talked about at the beginning, was we really need to be able to scale these devices as well, so that they're not losing the power of the cloud as I need to break into it. So, you know, once I hit the that app gateway, my next step is going to be my NSGs at layer 3, layer 4, where I am doing, you know, really just the 5-tuple. I'm going to look at the source destination, both of the IP address and the ports, but also what the protocol is. It's not going to work at layer 7. It's really going to look at CIDR ranges and IP addresses, or specific IP addresses. And that's going to allow for my inbound access to just have another layer of protection. What's cool about the inbounds is that I can have a source as well. So my source can be my app gateway, so that I'm only allowing traffic in from there. Mm-hmm. And then finally, once I hit the endpoint, I can have additional network security groups at the network interface as well. not only at the subnet. And so that's a great from functionality from there. And then they work the same way going outbound as well. Outbound, I have NSGs that will just work in the opposite direction. And then what I see customers typically do who are very security conscious is they will have an egress security stack as well. So I can inspect going outbound. And they do the same types of checks going outbound. A lot of customers will do layer 7 inspection going outbound. They will do five tuple type of NSG flow logging. And like I said before, Network Watcher has that capability to be able to look at the allows and denies coming out of the NSG layer as well. So all up, like I said, NVAs have a play in both ingress and egress. I think for very security conscious customers, they're going to want both. They want to be able to look at both. Some of the functionalities with multi-IP address and VNet peering allows me to actually use the same device, so I can have my ingress and egress stack be the exact same device. And again, it's just a cool functionality that makes it so that I don't have to have four NVAs. I can maybe only have two and maybe scale them out only as needed.
Right. No, that's very good, flow that you described over there. Nice, very nice. Evan, is there any more questions that we have for Jared? I think this has been a wealth of information.
No, it was. This is kind of my night to go back and revel in the networking between work and here. So no, this is great. Thanks, Jared.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Thanks for having me.
And Jared, if there's anything, specific links or topics that you've seen on the net that you think our listeners might like, send me the link and I'll put them in the show notes along with this episode. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one pitch I would have really quick is Yusuf Khalidi, who's the CVP of Azure Networking, just did a 7-part session, I believe, on Azure's networking. I mean, he went incredibly deep into our environment and our architecture globally. He talks about the global dark fiber network, really, really kind of cool information, very, very, very in-depth. And I think it's just really beneficial for our customers to see how committed we are on the network front as well.
Yeah, so, it is a really neat series. So yeah, I would agree with you, Jared. It's great. It's a great read
for the show notes. Yeah, great idea. All right, guys, thanks again for all your insights, both of you. That was a nice back and forth going on there. So that was good.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sounds good,
Jared.
See you guys.
Good talking to you as always. Take care.
Yep. See ya. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.